Arise, ye workers from your slumbers. Arise, ye prisoners of want. For reason and revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of cant. Away with all your superstition, servile masses, arise, arise. We'll change henceforth the old tradition, we'll spurn the dust to win the prize. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. No savior from on high delivers, no faith have we in Prince of Peer. Our own right hand the chains must shiver, chains of hatred, greed and fear. There the thieves will out with their booty, and give to all a happier lot. Each at the forge must do their duty, and will strike while the iron is hot. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. The Internationale unites the human race.
Welcome, welcome to the Three Lefts show. It's Saturday morning, live from Grand Street. I'm your host, Daniel Platt, broadcasting live from Albany, New York. Solo today. One-man show should usually be much more scripted than I'm going to be. I wasn't planning on being solo today, but we're in transition. So what I will do, though, is the show, as I was planning on it, is going to be a hodgepodge of a lot of different stories. So there's going to be a lot of touch and go, a lot of pauses, unfortunately, so I'm sorry for that. But I'll start with two, so I'll just go right into it. I've got a lot of tabs open here. I'll go into some recent stories, two recent, and then two older that are connected by theme. First, let me state that, so you're going to hear some the Internationale a bunch today. It's almost May Day. It's the Saturday before May Day. May Day is International Workers' Day. Started in the 19th century after a large event here in America, in Chicago. There was a massacre, as it were, by police on a workers' protest march. And in that kind of the memorial for that became May Day, and for all other revolutions, all other socialist movements in the world, May Day has significance in every country. And France especially, where we go to our first story, kind of labor news, but also just kind of a how to get things done, direct action style. Title, Air France workers rip shirts from executives after airline cuts 2,900 jobs. So this is from The Guardian, UK. Staff storm board meeting at Charles de Gaulle Airport and force executives to flee with one clambering over the fence half naked. Right. See, now my memory's been triggered. This is, in fact, 2 years old. Maybe I will, but, you know, it's always someone's first time hearing something like this. There's similar worker movements happening right now, even with a new president, Macron. He is, in fact, a neoliberal monster who is going after labor and worker protections that even we in America do not have. We're very much unprotected as workers. Striking staff at Air France have been demonstrating their anger with direct action to a shocking new level. Approximately 100 new workers forced away into a meeting of the senior management and ripped their shirts from their backs. So they were attacking them. The airline filed a criminal complaint after employees stormed their headquarters. But, you know, who makes the headquarters run? It's the workers. Very simply, company's profitability is on the backs of the workers. The workers depend on it. That is demand-side economics. That is the work and the labor being done that gives companies its value. Executives have no right to really managing it, or rather they manage it with the consent of their workers. And obviously if they're doing a piss poor job, or they're not having the workers or their customers' interests in mind, both in tandem, then people should revolt, and they do not have legitimacy. So violence erupted and all that, but there's video and pictures. It's really quite wonderful. And so even 2 years on, it's a good reminder of what workers can accomplish, because I'm sure they got a much stronger bargaining position after this. I actually do not know the overall, but let's shift to America for some labor news. This is from Telesur. Disclosure, Telesur is Venezuela's state media, but they cover American labor news better than our media does. I wonder why. But they put resources into covering workers' movements because the government represents workers' movements. Whether you think that's true or not, but that is the case. So this is, I've covered in an earlier show about, I mentioned Burgerville unionizing. I think whether it was via IWW or not. Yes, it is. International Workers of the World. Old radical union that's really getting on the upswing. Because in this world of union busting and the old guard unions fading away as the decrepit bureaucracies they are, and not being able to maybe even legally serve the interests of their workers, of their membership, new unions will be coming about in new ways of organizing. How it is done is still kind of open to where you are and what kind of strategies to use, but one strategy is the more informal union of the IWW. So the headline is Burgerville workers vote to become U.S.'s first fast food union. Now currently there is the kind of service employees union that I know organizes fast food joints, like here in Albany, SEIU. And they were organizing McDonald's workers, I believe, or at least leading the Fight for 15 March protests and what have you. That movement, which has at least downstate won, but upstate it's going to be much longer before we even get halfway to 15 with that 1250 in 2022. Makes me mad just thinking about how long we're going to have to wait before we can have something that's at least a proper wage, but still not the living wage, which would be more like 20, 25. So let's go with this story. The historic win comes after 2 years of effort, which peaked in February when workers called for a boycott of the fast food chain. In a major win for labor rights, workers of the U.S. fast food chain Burgerville, based in Portland, Oregon, have overwhelmingly voted for a federally recognized union, making it the first fast food union in the country to do so. To quote, "Our struggle is the struggle of all workers, everywhere fighting for a better world. No worker is isolated because we form a part of a working class that together can and will do anything. Workers have all the power, and we demonstrated that and continue to with this union victory and our march forward." This is what the Burgerville Workers Union told Telesur in a statement. So that's what's usually called the dogme gospel, the wobbly gospel. Wobblies are IWW members. The historic win comes after 2 years of the Portland Burgerville Workers Union campaigning efforts, which peaked in February when workers called for boycott of the fast food chain. Today, workers at the 92nd and Powell overwhelmingly voted yes, making the union formally recognized in the country, throughout the country. For a long time, people have dismissed fast food as unorganizable, saying that turnover is too high and the workers are too spread out. Today, Burgerville workers prove them wrong. Why? Because service jobs like these are the majority of jobs. So, and the majority of available jobs. If you ever read stats about job creation and that, jobs grew, they're in the service sector. They're low paying, they're temporary, or rather temporary, in that there's such turnover that it's almost like you expect it to only last at most a year. Or it's maybe in your mind it's temporary because, oh, I'm going to move on to something else, but not necessarily better. The measure would allow the workers to have a say in the food chain's decisions, which is also called worker management. Even if that's representative, like having a worker or worker representative on the board of directors in those executive boardrooms, like the ones that the airline workers attacked. Burgerville is now legally required to negotiate with the store's workers who have been pushing for a wage increase, affordable health care, and other benefits. We got here because of the strike union benefits, pickets, and marches on the boss, the union emphasized on its Facebook page. The fight isn't over, of course. We still need to bargain a fair contract with Burgerville, and until that then, the boycott still stands. And we need to remember what got us to this point. Workers taking action for themselves, standing up against poverty wages and horrible conditions. Mark Melinda, a store employee and a union organizer, told the Oregonian Monday, "A lot of us are poor, hungry, and even homeless. We hope this will be the beginning of an end to poverty wages." There's a lot of nonprofits in Albany and elsewhere in the country that will use rhetoric about, like, we're solving poverty one step at a time. I'm going to be very blunt. They are lying. Not so much out of malice, but just misunderstanding of how to solve poverty. And this solves poverty. This is what killed this worker control, the ability to plan and manage your own economic destiny instead of capital as a force. Because as long as that's the case, poverty must exist. There must be pressure on workers to accept lower wages. There must always be an underclass. That is what the homeless and the people who truly work for as little as possible. That would be migrant labor. Some of the demands listed by Burgerville Union on its website include a $5 raise for all hourly Burgerville workers, affordable quality health care, a safe and healthy workplace. This is the standard list of supportive, sustainable workplace, including paid maternity leave and paternity. Maternity and paternity, meaning both parents. Currently, the minimum wage at the food joint is $11.25. Higher than it is here in Albany, which is $10.50. And that's Oregon's, I guess. Or maybe it's Portland in particular. But it's still poverty wages. And I disagree with the rhetoric used by Bernie Sanders in that, like, you shouldn't be poor and have a full-time job. I would extend that to say no one should be poor in America. Right? That means, as he's doing now, in fact, announcing that he supports the guaranteed job program, which is really just New Deal Keynesianism in the first place. It means what all Democrats should be supporting. It's what Democrats were pushed to support in the New Deal era by socialist movements, because that's what socialist movements were demanding. Job guarantee, income guarantee, big welfare state. And in the 21st century, I would disagree that we should depend on welfare state economics. But that's another topic. So here's what the Burgerville Corporation says, represented by Beth Brewer. Senior VP of Operations said the company supports the workers' decision, as they always do after the fact. "We are proud of our relationship with our co-workers, and we will continue to provide a fair, positive work environment for all," she said in a statement. "We are ready to support the nation's first unionized fast food store," she added. Last week, the workers at another location also filed a request for an election with the National Labor Relations Board set up in the New Deal era. Burgerville has about 1,500 employees in Oregon and Southern Washington. So this is just the beginning. And it's always nice to see corporate VPs make statements of friendship and cooperation, when usually, no, by design, most enterprises, not usually by choice, are set up to be competitive, to be hierarchy, a big pyramid. And fighting pyramids in our society especially ones that cannot be justified. That is anarchism. And in this podcast, in this show, which I didn't give the full intro, is representing socialist, anarchist, and generally commons economy perspective, ideas. This is not a theory show, but I will talk about ideas. This is not just a practice show, but we will talk about what people are doing and strategies and tactics. And this is not just a news show on the treadmill of current events. Because if that were the case, I could be talking about Korea right now. And how they're making peace without us, or rather, hopefully, the U.S. government will let go, take the hit of profits from the war industry for all the material that needs to go into maintaining the situation of war that's there. The two Korean governments are making peace. Why? Because people demand it. And this, make no mistake, people. This is because there are movements from below. Blame, or rather credit, definitely should not go to Trump. It should not even go to Kim and Moon, respective prime minister and dear leader. It should go to people on the ground. Moon is in office because there is a massive anti-war movement filling the streets. Not just once, but night after night after night. Calling for the resignation of the more conservative-leaning, hawkish government that was charging for war, or rather just tensions, which keep people afraid, and thus the status quo. And now that status quo is changing. There are nice little cute videos of Kim and Moon planting a tree, crossing each other's borders. It's all very daw and cute. And so that's definitely something to feel good about. So another kind of update continuing stories. Previous episode, I covered a small-time also-ran presidential candidate who just announced. Pretty early, I suppose, but it's more a issue campaign that's going to be ongoing. And it's for basic income by a man named Yang. He's in his 40s. And so he's promoting a universal basic income. He put at $1,000 a month, which would be $12,000 a year. And that is kind of supportive. But like most, even very radical reforms like basic income, which is getting there's a lot of good conversations and it's getting more airplay. But as far as political will and the ability to even implement it by this captured government, captured by capital, that remains to be seen. And it's hard to fix one section of our society, whether it be the guaranteeing of a standard of living for everyone, regardless of their able-bodiedness, race, sex, and so on. Mental faculties. There's also other interplaying forces that will get in the way of one particular policy fixing what ails us, or addressing the serious injustices of our society. That is why I take a revolutionary approach. You need to change, or see the perspective that change has to be completely structural. It has to be everything, if not all at once, but it has to be on the plate, on the table, in the cards. We need to be changing everything, not just getting money out of politics in the elections, but completely restructuring how we vote and why we vote. Then our economy, is it just a matter of everyone unionizing? As long as there is still management that is disconnected from the labor, from the actual doing of things? Is it just a matter of union reps doing the managing? Is that enough? Or is that just creating another hierarchy? Those are the questions that that anarchists and other theorists would ask throughout the 20th century, that are much more pertinent to us today as our economic system is sluggishly declining. So with that, so there are various experiments in basic income happening throughout the world. Finland is one such place. And it's going to end that their experiment after a two-year trial. So it was just a trial period. It was a pilot. So it wasn't universal, but it was a basic income program. So this is by Time Magazine. This is who was reporting on it, I guess, and maybe I'll find a better article and share more details, because as Time is written for a lower grade level, perhaps the average American's grade level, reading comprehension, it's short and it's simple. By Eli Mexler, Finland has decided not to extend its trial in universal basic income, the first welfare experiment of its kind, by a European government that gave citizens an unconditional monthly payment. So it certainly has the unconditional part of it. Other experiments have been done in Ontario, Canada, and I think Holland is playing around with it. The government rejected a request from KILA, the country's social security agency, for additional funding to expand the innovative two-year pilot program, meaning it will come to an end. So this is The Guardian reporting on this, actually, and Time is just relaying it. The program, which Finland inaugurated in January of 17, saw 2,000, the pilot program was just 2,000 jobless people, jobless, not unemployed, receive, different use of language, receive $685 per month, less than the 1,000 that Yang was talking about, without requiring them to work or seek employment. But that still is a slap in the face to the, what we call it, the means testing. You have to deserve what you get. You have to work hard, kind of thing. But everyone is entitled to the benefits of living in their society. Because even when you're not working a job, a for-profit job or a non-profit job, you're still contributing to the society by existing, just in ways that cannot be measured by the market. But could certainly be written out and articulated. Finland's unemployment rate has hit a 17-year high at 10%, prompting calls for welfare reform. Now, I don't know if welfare reform means cutting welfare so that more people are, you know, it's assumed that if you cut welfare, more people will be able to work, or that people are not working because they have welfare. This is patently unsupported by evidence. In December 2017, the Finnish Parliament introduced legislation requiring jobless people to work at least 18 hours every 3 months to qualify for unemployment benefits, signaling that the welfare regime could be shifting in the opposite direction. Advocates of UBI programs, which have become more popular in recent years, argue that guaranteeing a baseline pay for adult citizens can help alleviate social issues like crime, poverty, and chronic unemployment. And that is backed by every time it is done, that is what happens. But critics contend that UBI programs are costly and ineffective. They are full of it. They need to actually back up their claims, which they don't. Because we've reformed welfare by cutting it and cutting access to it here in America. And somehow poverty has only grown since the 90s. Now we're back to 1950 levels of half the country being either below or near the poverty line at risk. They are one paycheck away from being in poverty. And more people are in the underclass than ever. So these critics, these people in power. So this is definitely political in nature. This program was not ending because it doesn't work. Is simply it doesn't seem to be the political will. I don't know what the electoral situation in Finland is, but it gives you a sense that you can still have the social democracy, you know, what Bernie is promoting, and Finns are much happier than Americans. Demonstrable. But that doesn't mean you have the forces of reaction. By that meaning, politicians that will stand by trickle-down economics to their dying breath. Why? Because they're comfortable, they're fine, and they don't need to. They lack solidarity with others, with the underclass. They just see it as a personal, individual problem. But UBI is definitely seeing things in a social way. So moving on to two also international stories, much older, but demonstrative of the global capitalist system and how it prevents progress in real, tangible ways. Despite progress being made in other areas, even locally with our growing solar industry, of installers and such, it's still in spite of capital forces, the inertia of power. So this is from Grist magazine. I saved this a good while ago, 2 years ago, in fact, also 2 years ago. The story is titled WTO, that's World Trade Organization, swats down India's massive solar initiative, by Clayton Aldrin, February of 2016. The World Trade Organization delivered a blow to India's ambitious solar power program on Wednesday at the behest of the United States. So much for all that nice chatter about international climate cooperation back in December. Responding to a U.S. complaint, a WTO dispute panel ruled that several provisions of India's national solar mission were, quote, inconsistent with international trade norms. So to give you a general background, the World Trade Organization was created in the late 90s. America, particularly Bill Clinton, signed it, even though all labor and progressive groups told him no and opposed it. And that's what the battle in Seattle in 99 was all about, the signing, the creation of the WTO, which is the international institution that enforces the American-dominated trade regime. To be outside of it is to be, as our government calls them, broke states. And to be within that trade regime is to follow America's rules and America's lead for America's benefit. There is no justice in that. And here's an example of that. The point of contention, India's solar plan, which seeks to install 100 gigawatts of solar capacity by 2022, not a quite recent near goal, requires a certain percentage of cells and panels to be manufactured locally. So that's part of being green. Not only do you install solar power, that you should make it within your own country and not have to import it from other places. These type of provisions, called domestic content requirements, are prohibited under most international trade agreements. Want to be part of the WTO? You gotta be open to trade every time, or you're guilty of the dreaded protectionism. This is one of those things that made Trump a little popular, even though he was completely lying. But even just bringing up that protectionism has benefits for local economies. An estimated 300 million Indians don't have access to electricity. The country's solar plan, launched in 2010, aims to change that, while simultaneously combating poverty via job creation. And while India has indeed made strides in adding solar capacity, the U.S. argues that the solar mission's domestic content requirements have led to a 90% decrease in its solar exports to India since 2011. The export losses led the U.S. to file a WTO complaint. So India's job growth is apparently America's job losses. In August of last year, the WTO panel released a preliminary ruling against the Indian domestic content requirements, and Wednesday's ruling finalized that decision. So just the general content of this article is describing that in our global capitalist market, there must be losers. It is negative competition, that in order for India to have a local solar industry, or a robust one anyway, that American jobs must be lost. And in order for there to be a growth in American solar industry jobs, India and other nations cannot develop their solar industry. they must be dependent on our industry. As the most of the world was in the 50s and 60s, it caused our economic boom. You know, the rest of the world was in ruin, literal ruin. And there was no one else to buy from except America. Now things have changed. The rest of the world has rebuilt a long time ago. And now you have competing trade regimes, trading systems. WTO is challenged by growing Chinese market and their trade relationships that they're have created. And that's trouble for the American economy, but only because it is so dependent now on services, not making things, and exporting what we do make abroad. As long as countries accept what we make by consent or by force if necessary. And that's what wars in the 21st century usually about. When it comes to American expansion, the enforcement of treaties like this, the enforcement of the ability for America to export, the surplus that it creates. We make too much of everything. It's unsustainable. Not only physically, because of the strain on the environment, the mass extinction we're causing. Not only is white rhino now officially extinct, the giraffe is on its way too. The giraffe. Kids love giraffes. And American trophy hunters are apparently putting them at risk. Slowly being put on the endangered list. And then some. And it's shocking. It's horrifying. What these monsters are doing in the name of competing and being the winners in the global system. So back to more kind of horrifying international news, just demonstrating the times we're living in and the bigger picture of the world, and that it does in fact come home, that it does in fact affect us here in New York or America. So the other international story that's a bit old, it's about a year now, just 1 year old, but it very much fits with that trade organizations enforcing the dominance of not U.S. workers, but U.S. corporations in particular. So this one's Tanzania and Africa, forced to embrace seed patents or risk losing development aid. So this is a GMO story. GMO is a little dicey, especially because the problems with them are usually misrepresented. There's a large contingent that's very loud that represents GMOs as a health issue, particularly nutrition, or like in terms of eating genetically modified foods. I am not one of those people. My criticism of GMOs is that it is a patented technology, proprietary, owned by companies like particularly Monsanto. And they use that patent to abuse and price gouge farmers and entire industries, agricultural industries, that like a big racket. They develop the technology, so they should get a cut, a piece of the action whenever anyone uses their seeds, the seeds created by their technology. But part of their technology is making sure that seeds don't germinate, so that you have to keep buying them, almost like a planned obsolescence. But instead of an iPhone every year, it's your entire stock of seeds. And then there's the trade organizations and the trade deals made that create a system enforced by law and violence, and thus implied violence, that forces farmers to buy GMO seeds. And that's where the true injustice lies. That is not, in fact, a choice to use these or not. It's not a matter of GMO crops are better. That is sometimes the case, but not particularly always. They're usually bred to be better at accepting pesticides and better at being harvested in an industrial fashion. So you increase yields a little bit, but then you're destroying the environment utterly. Industrializing agriculture, which then destroys small farmers. It creates a very alienating food system that I think we all can recognize at some basic level. So this is from Mint Press News. Mint Press News is a bit hit or miss at times with their accuracy, but that's kind of all internet news outlets. But Mint Press is independent, and they kind of focus on these on-the-ground social injustice, but economic injustice stories. So they're great at covering the war machine in action and other things like that. And they would be lumped into by the establishment as being that conspiracy theory kind of fake news. But I, like most government propaganda, you should kind of assume the opposite, or at least be skeptical of what's called fake news. No, it's usually real, and it's just a matter of how is it being represented, the story. So I'm going to represent it in hopefully a fair way, in the fair way I want to. Agribusiness companies are taking advantage of Tanzania's desperate need for aid but to push a development plan that will allow them to dominate the country's agriculture sector and plunge farmers into debt. A similar plan led to a suicide epidemic among Indian farmers in recent years. Written by Whitney Webb, June of 2017. From Minneapolis, where they're writing this. A, quote, development assistance initiative launched 5 years ago by the G8, the Intergovernmental Political Forum of the world's most industrialized nations, including the U.S., that consider themselves democracies, when they're really plutocracies, or at least governed by corporate power, is holding Tanzania hostage to the benefit of agribusiness and the detriment of small-scale Tanzanian farmers. The New Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition, founded by the G8 in 2012 to ostensibly end hunger and poverty for 50 million people, has forced the Tanzanian government to amend its laws to drastically favor agribusiness and seed companies if it wishes to continue receiving development assistance aid. Monsanto, one of the prime partners of this new alliance for food security, is sent to benefit from these changes to Tanzania's laws. The NAFSN is funded by the EU, the US, the UK, the World Bank, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The alliance has secured approximately $37 billion in private sector investment in signatory countries that signed in Africa as of June 2012, a figure which is said to have since expanded, though no new figures have been released. While this new institution was supported to benefit small-scale farmers, so good intentions on the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and other companies, local farming organizations were shut out of the negotiations, however, while agribusiness lobbyists had unprecedented access to those drafting the requirements of signatory countries seeking developmental assistance. Tanzania's government, which administers one of the world's least developed countries, was desperate for the aid. Due to this economic pressure, the Tanzanian legislature obliged. Per the new legislation, foreign commercial investors would be given faster and easier access to agricultural land in the African nation, meaning they can just scoop it up from underneath the people who live on it, as well as strong protections for intellectual property rights, i.e. seed patenting. Patented seeds, largely products of behemoth seed companies like Monsanto and Syngenta, often pop up in neighboring farms that use traditional seeds via cross-pollination, a phenomenon that has been used by Monsanto and similar companies to sue small-scale farmers for, quote, stealing their intellectual property. There's a lot of precedent for that. In addition, seeds that are not patented, i.e. all seeds traditionally used by Tanzanian farmers, you know, the kind of plants that are suited for the climate and the tastes of the people living there and the diets that they're used to having, are now forbidden from being sold or even given to friends or family, threatening the centuries-old tradition of seed exchanges that have kept costs down for farmers. Michael Felde of the Tanzanian Organic Agriculture Movement told Mandadial News, I guess that's the more regional news outlet there, that 80% of the seeds are being shared and sold in an informal system between neighbors, friends, and family, also called the horizontal network. The new law criminalizes the practice in Tanzania. Now, broadly speaking, this is called enclosure, where with state power, a private interest bans what people usually do, historically do, in order to force people to then adopt what the private interest, what would benefit the private interest. This is how most development has actually occurred in the developing world. Large companies buy up all the land. Laws are passed which force, that prevent local economies from functioning, and then all the land is bought up. The people on that land then can't survive. They have to move, and thus mass migrations occur. That is what happened in Mexico in the last few decades. That is why we have these millions of poor Mexicans coming north for work. They were all farmers. They all had incomes. They all had lives. And things were okay. But in the name of progress in the Green Revolution from the 70s onward, lands were consolidated into fewer and fewer owners. Their economies were broken up and made illegal. They're informal economies because, hey, people aren't able to make money off of these informal networks. And here in America, the so-called sharing economy is all about making money, making a profit off of what people usually could do for each other. The informal networks of sharing apartments and our cars, they're made into business models, making us all exploitable. So it's not just your information that's for sale via social media. Your very body, your very social networks, the ability that you have family and friends, that is something to be exploited, something to make money off of by firms. And that horrifies me. I don't know how you feel about it. So to finish up here, if Tanzanian farmers break the new law barring seed exchange, they face a minimum prison sentence of 12 years and a $230,000 fine, or both. Considering that the average wage in Tanzania is less than $2 a day, the punishment seems rather draconian considering the nature of the quote-unquote crime. However, the new laws themselves are likely illegal under international law, as if that was ever followed, though. As Article 9 of the International Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture, also known as the Sea Treaty, states that no law should limit any rights that farmers have to save, use, and exchange and sell farm-saved seed propagating material. But affected Tanzanian farmers will likely be unable to make a viable court case against the new legislation due to their limited economic resources. You can only enforce the law with lawyers, and you have to be able to afford lawyers. So otherwise, laws can be quite useless if it comes to ensuring justice for the poor. This is why I'm not always supportive of legalism. When laws are passed, they benefit those that already have economic resources, the kind that allow them to get justice even without passing a broad law. They can sue and get what they desire. That is how most progressive things happen in America, actually, and it kind of drives me crazy. This talk of mass movements and passing laws and fixing the system, when usually justice is either enforced or gotten through courts, whether it be stopping Muslim bans, gay marriage, all through courts, which also opens the door then to rolling back gains by workers and marginalized people by the courts. As state right to work is about to go national due to a current court case, and public sector unions are going to be seriously hit. So be prepared for them to be even more inconsequential as the years follow. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, back to them, one of the funding partners, is particularly well known for pushing the interests of big agribusiness on small-scale farmers in developing countries, as evidenced by one of the Gates Foundation's most successful initiatives, the introduction of GMO cotton to India. Despite the promise that GM cotton would increase yields, a promise in many a propaganda video, this turns out not to be the case, and Indian farmers who adopted the GM crops became trapped by debt. So even if they grew more cotton, they were never able to pay back the costs of accepting in the first place. As their disappointing yields, it didn't grow more, left them unable to pay for the expensive seeds and chemicals needed to cultivate GM plants. This debt slavery soon led to one of the largest suicide epidemics in global history, with, get this, 300,000 Indian farmers having committed suicide over the last 20 years. That is indirect murder, ladies and gentlemen. Unreported by our news agencies. That's Monsanto and Bill Melinda Gates indirectly murdering 300,000 people by taking away their livelihoods, forcing them to grow GM cotton. That is why I am not supportive of GMOs. At least as far as being a owned technology, captured, not available to others to experiment with and to use. If GMO technology was more accessible and not used and not owned and carried out in this way, I'd actually would be for it. The potential promises could actually be fulfilled. But as it is now, I think small-scale genocide is what is occurring here. Despite this travesty, though, Monsanto-owned companies such as Cargill and Dow Chemical have benefited handsomely from India's quote-unquote green revolution, seeing the value of their stocks skyrocket. The Gates Foundation itself has financially benefited as well due to its multi-million-dollar investments in all three companies. If the new laws being forced on Tanzania are any indication, the African nation may soon follow in India's footsteps. Perhaps all these farmers are already dead. So I'm desperately fuming on the inside just rereading this. I've been aware of this information, and I hope it's upsetting, makes you uncomfortable, that the cotton in your shirt might have come from the fields of these overworked, overburdened with debt farmers. And we're not safe from this. We're not safe at all. Many farmers in America have been destroyed, at least economically. I mean, do you think it's a coincidence we have a heroin epidemic, painkillers? That's what you turn to when your world's been destroyed by these systems. And to me, treating people for the opioid crisis is, of course, necessary. But if you want to treat the disease, This is the disease. The regime of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I'm not a fan of these foundations. I do not support what they do because in the name of helping people, they in fact kill people and destroy entire societies for their bottom line. All with good intentions. So with that, we've hit our first hour. This is the Three Left Show. Thank you.
Katarina Yakov, long before she took that name, was organizing workers in Hamburg just the same. Organizing beneath the flag of deepest red, a new dawn of peace and freedom clearly shining in her head. Katarina Yakov first was sent to jail when the trappings of democracy all began to fail. She was frequently arrested, in and out of custody, while her first husband was in hiding from the Nazis. Katarina Yakov was acquitted of a crime, but the Gestapo had the last word. They weren't finished with her this time. She was sent to Ravensbrück, a killing hunger at her side. She heard of the execution, how her second husband died. For Katarina Yakov, the end was close at hand. She was on a death march with a ragged, starving band. Marching through a forest, being led by the SS. What would happen hours later seemed impossible to guess. When the sun came the next morning, it was the 1st of May, and they all sang the Internationale. They all sang the Internationale. Katarina Yakov thought about her children and the friends and comrades taking care of them, not knowing yet if any of them survived, not knowing that soon she'd see her daughters both alive. Katarina Yakov watched the German soldiers flee, streaming from the east, that's what she was seeing. Allied bombers flew above them, she thought they all might die, and then soon there was the silence of all the SS men. When the sun rose the next morning, it was the 1st of May, and they all sang the Internationale. They all sang the Internationale. Katarina Yakov saw red flags flapping in the breeze above the Russian tanks, and she fell upon her knees. And so many different voices in so many different tongues sang the most beautiful song that could ever have been sung. In German, Lithuanian, in Polish, and in Dutch, a myriad of melodies as never had been such. In Russian and in Yiddish, Italian and French, emerging from the forest beneath the trench. When the sun rose the next morning, it was the 1st of May, and they all sang the Internationale. When the sun rose the next morning, it was the 1st of May, and they all sang the Internationale. They all sang the Internationale.
All right. Welcome back to the Three Left Show, the show of socialist anarchist politics, radical left commentary, and news. And if you would like to sing the Internationale with comrades here in Albany on this May 1st, there will be a march down Central Ave, starting from Central Ave in South Northlake, at the Lady of the Americas Church, that's the Hispanic Church, and also starting at the Masjid, almost across the street, but a little down the block. So that particular block between Quail and North Lake, there will be the congregation. marchers. We'll march down Central. We'll have some speeches along the way. There will be music. And we'll have a luncheon at the Union Building, Bradford Hall, called the one next to the main branch library. And that's starting at 11, I believe. Check the Facebook page for that. It's put on by the Solidarity Committee of Albany. We've had a May Day march since the mid-90s. And lately, we've been having a theme of immigration, migrant issues, anti-fighting ICE, our American Gestapo, who does, in fact, grab people in the middle of the night that are all fascist, not just in, because I'm calling them that, but if you see them in action, I think you'll be horrified that this is, you'll have to, there needs to be an acceptance. This is America. This is America. And it's like, you can say all you want, this is not us. This is not who we're supposed to be. Find and do something about it. Now, I'm a socialist because to me, it delivers the goods. And by the goods, I'm actually referring to the realization of liberal goals. What am I talking about? Let's take diversity in our government. To have just as many women as men. To have full gender or sex parity. That there are women in power. We just had a talk. The mayor, Jill Stein, and two others that I didn't commit to memory, were off on Wolf Road for a talk, a little panel discussion, women in power. And how do we get that? How do we achieve that in America? And it seems such a hard question. And to me, it's made much clearer and easier, more binary almost. In what societies and what style of governments is there more gender parity? And there is a visible trend. The more socialist the government, the more equal gender parity there is, the more representation of what the actual society looks like. Right now in Congress, it's mostly millionaires, rich, white people. Those that are of color are also well off. They couldn't have run for Congress without their own resources or the ability to sell out to those who do. And that's both parties. That is why I'm green, but particularly I'm explaining that I'm a socialist, because when it comes historically and in the present, if you want to see where the gender equality is actually achieved, it's in those places where there was a socialist revolution, or in the case of Northern Europe, a slow, steady reforms towards social democracy. Still capitalist in its economic construction. So there's still reactionary forces there, you know, politicians that say that we shouldn't provide everyone with a basic level of living, as covered in the first story. But here's some stats from Cuba. All right, they have a new president now. President is not a god king. President is simply a leader in terms of setting the tone of what the government is doing. Otherwise, there's all these other actors, particularly its parliament, which, if you watch the minimal content relating to Cuba's government, you'd think are all just robots that follow the lead of the president, what power do they have? They have plenty of power. They do all kinds of things. And here are some stats. 53% of the Cuban parliament are women. So this is a video from Telesur, by the way. Again, yes. Venezuelan state TV. And if it's private Venezuelan TV, you can be sure it will have the opposite messaging. That everything is terrible, that there needs to be a U.S. intervention, like Iraq, because that worked out. Or at least there needs to be an overthrow of the government there, even though they're very popular. Same as Cuba. Because why? It drives me up the bend when talking about social, you know, the nominally socialist countries of how unfree they are and how terrible things are and how liberal. But as far as equality and the kind of liberal goals, they're actually doing it better. You know, they have access to healthcare. There are general services that everyone can get. And that's the main thing. Revolution is a benefit to majority, particularly the poor majority. And whether everyone's equally poor, at least they all have healthcare, social services, and access to government, which is the case in Cuba. They have more democracy than we do. More delegates, more representation. Same as Venezuela. They have more elections there. More elections. And they're all fair. They're monitored. Unlike here in America, where they're unmonitorable. You cannot monitor our elections. They are too corrupt. The machines, too hackable. Anyone who draws attention to this is called a Russian bot. Or some kind of Putin supporter to criticize our election system. To say that others are doing it better. That Cuba has better representation, even. So it's Cuba has a, what is it called? The country parliament. It has 322 female delegates. They have a very large legislature. Why? Because people are better represented. The groupings are smaller. Drives me nuts. The League of Women Voters for the station, they support making this county legislature smaller, making it for the literally less representation. At the moment, it's one person for every 6,000 residents. Now, I think that's too much. As far as that's too many people per representative. And that's the same on the city level. You know, the wards don't seem very large. But as far as fielding complaints from 6,000 people, it's a lot. It's hard to know everyone. And it's represented in our elections, in the outcomes. They're elected with a minority of the people in each area. Are they really accountable by the whole neighborhood? Of course not. So that's, I have 605 members, so, you know, that 53% percentage. Only Rwanda has a higher percentage of women in its female representation. I'm reading the text here. And 40% of Cuba's parliament are Afro-Cuban. They are of darker skin color, which for all of Cuba's history, they've been at the bottom of the pyramid, much like African Americans here in America. But now 40% is, and guess what? That's representative of their stake in the population. So that's a more equal, fair representative government in Cuba than here. Economics aside, even barring that conversation, just talking about liberal representation, it's better. Speaking of liberal representation, we have I'm going to turn to a really fine focus local story. The drama between the city of Albany and the state, all having to do with taxation, budgets, you know, boring stuff like that. But if you want to actually have the good, the cool stuff, the social, the after school programs, the ability to fix all the potholes, all right, these things are political, you know. The bread and butter issues, as one Green suggested that we work on. This is from the Times Union, Hearst Rag. Headline, State Budget Official Comment Stuns Albany Officials. Budget spokesman on the state level suggests state aid that gives Albany a surplus is unfair to taxpayers. Now, just giving you the background, a majority of land in Albany is untaxed, right? There are tons of institutions and private individuals and companies that do not pay property taxes. Any new developer gets, like a 10-year reprieve from paying taxes. So certainly things are very, quote, fair for them. Unfair for us, especially since the state is unfair in giving aid to the city of Albany. We get less than other cities, even though other cities have more private land that's taxable. So this is filed by Amanda Fries. So public criticism from the state budget division have many occupants of City Hall scratching their heads after years of dialogue between Albany officials and the state. So I think this is the second or third year that we have, I think it's the second, that we've received about $12 million from the state to help balance our budget. The city of Albany has proven time and time again that, and I'm not reading at the moment, that we have done more with less, and so on and so on. And cut to the bone, the city of Albany balancing its budget, being fiscally conservative, as many socially liberal people, voters, usually. The voter base of Albany is socially liberal, fiscally conservative. Which just means, at the very least, they're moderates. And it just means they're capitalists to me, I guess. It means all kinds of things. So the new state budget strikes a balance by making $12 million available if needed. This is the state budget official speaking. The new state budget strikes a balance by making $12 million available if needed while ensuring that Albany pursues efficiencies. Last year, state money helped Albany achieve a surprise $6 million surplus, and that's not fair to state taxpayers. His use of the words, if needed, suggested that the city would receive that amount from the state this year only if that's how much is needed to balance the budget. If the budget division's position is that the city of Albany shouldn't be building up a fund balance, and this aid isn't fair because of that, we disagree, says Brian Shea, Mayor Sheehan's chief of staff. We're building from having a completely depleted fund balance. To penalize us as we are trying to build one, that is unfair. Albany has been working with the state budget office. And by the way, fund balance is the thing that's required to fill the potholes. Because, see, any maintenance, unless you can plan all the maintenance you're going to do and know exactly how much it is, that's hard to plan. You need surpluses. And if we're having just a balanced budget, there's no surplus, which means there's no extra to fix anything, only maintain. Only maintain as our city slowly declines. Now, because of these, the state aid, the 12 million, it's 12 and a half, but see, this year it's just 12. That's half a million less. That's half a million less to pay for potholes and save and all the things that our parks are missing. Our parks, you know, there's improvements here and there, but there's a complete lack of water fountains and benches in other parks. I'm tired of being in some of the smaller parks, and there's just no amenities. No tables. You have to bring your own everything. It's a little out of touch, said Rachel McNenny, Commissioner of Administrative Services in City Hall. The statement is very damaging to what we've worked hard, that we've worked hand in glove with the budget office on. So the state budget office is kind of providing oversight. They've got a magnifying glass on City Hall to make sure they're saving as much money as possible, following austerity policies, cutting social programs, making sure that we charge poor families for using summer programs and such, that kind of stuff. At the time, City Treasurer Darius Schanifer emphasized this shouldn't be misconstrued as permanent savings. The announcement of the savings, the $6 million mentioned before, was made in June 2017 after the city received $12.5 million in additional state funding. In 2016, Albany received that year's budget gap closing $12.5 million as a spin-up or advance on payments the state owes for the Empire State Plaza being off the city tax rolls, which typically has been the case. Final figures for 2017 are not yet available. Credit rating agencies want localities to have healthy fund balances to have a surplus. And State Controller Thomas DiNapoli has dinged Albany for its past shortcomings in that regard. Albany continues to be categorized as under significant financial stress in part due to its lack of savings. The state budget office on Tuesday provided a chart that suggested the state... Ooh, they had a shiny chart. Suggested the state aid Albany receives as aid to municipalities, has its own name, funds, plus the $15 million it receives in payment for the Empire State Plaza being off the tax rolls, and the additional $12 million it received with the budget deal brings Albany more in line with other upstate cities. The plaza payments were established through a state public lands law that allows any city with 75,000 residents or more to seek payments from the state for property it takes off the tax rolls. However, the state's chart shows only $161 million going to Buffalo, while Buffalo's own 2017-18 budget shows $194 million coming from the state. So the chart that the state is using to say that Albany is getting not just enough money from the state in aid, but too much, is a incorrect chart. Not to mention that it's a misrepresentation to say that giving the city what it owes for the plaza is itself also a gift. So that's kind of the drums here, that the city's doing as fiscal managers and not creators of social policy, because they're everything's political, but they almost kind of like they're elected to be as non-political as possible. They're only fiscal managers, and any policy has to be pitched in the realm, in the context of whether or not it's saving the city money or whether or not it's going to, say, increase the tax rolls. It's a line of argument I am not a fan of. I understand that you need to make sure the budget's balanced and make sure things are, you're able to pay for things. But it kind of ignores the political calculations in what kind of spending choices we're making now. But the drums here is that the city's doing everything possible to be efficient, to cut, to be austerity, you know, to work with a scarcity mindset, despite the growth that, say, our regional economy has. And they're still being chastised by the state. They're still being told it's not enough. If anything, it's unfair that you have to cut so much and you're not having to close schools like Philadelphia and Detroit. You know, that you don't have to actually cut off water service or just leave complete sections of town utterly neglected. But hey, you know, that's what previous mayors did. And for once we have a mayor, and it's kind of a reason for her own popularity, is that she actually doesn't just say, or rather just doesn't go act like the opposite. But, you know, she doesn't have to be forced to try to actually maintain the whole city. And for this, just that base level of impartiality, that let's not completely cut an entire city, part of the city off, particularly the poor areas, from city services. Trying to maintain some level of decency. But again, what's decent about charging poor families for summer programs? But that's the kind of stuff that the state is effectively forcing us to do by not providing us the proper amount of aid. Or paying us the proper amount for all the property that is off the rolls, like the plaza, like the Capitol itself. One direct action the city could take is to cut off the water to the Capitol. But I understand that would also kind of look bad as well. Being petulant children, oh, you're not being responsible. And the state's just trying to hold us accountable. But for what? For spending on our citizens? For trying to be fair and equitable? There is no equitable agenda without justice on the state level. That's why you can't just do everything on a local level, though it's usually where politics starts. It's where things are most accessible. You can call the mayor's office and talk to Brett. But otherwise, the state law hems in a lot of what they can do, what's allowed. There's a lot of laws in place to prevent localities from taking charge, from, you know, even... and that's kind of, again, to me, it's that this current thought process that I'm on is what leads me to that revolutionary point of view. You got to take the whole thing down. Reforming piecemeal, it's not going to work. Forces of reaction are going to stop you. You run as a progressive in a Democratic primary, they're good at sabotaging. They're caught lying about everything. Talking about the DNC. All these hot mics, kind of can of camera documents, internal memos. It's clear. They don't want progress. They like how things are. They're millionaires. They'll be fine. Yeah, so as I suspected, that has taken half the time left. Oh, right. So no clear segue here, but for the remainder of the show, besides playing a rock version of The International, so I started with a folksy English version, and then we're going to end with a version from the People's Republic of China, from their state television, with the best singers, and it's pretty fun to listen. But just to show I don't just have this kind of top-down commie government bias here, I'm going to talk about anarchism. Practical steps. So let's end the show with practical steps. So when I say anarchy, there's a lot of American media. In fact, it is the trope. You likely have the idea that anarchy is chaos, and that someone who is an anarchist is nihilistic, doesn't care about anything. You know, the Joker, the someone who just bombs for the hell of it because they can, or, you know, there's almost no ideology there, and that's wrong, and that's by design. Not that it's like people are literally thinking I'm going to bash an anarchist because I but usually there is kind of an ideology there. It's the pure ideology that we need a state, we need top-down governance, and that's something that this show disputes. I'm not gonna go deep now into the rationale for that. I'm gonna assume that, let's say, you don't like unjustifiable hierarchies, pyramids, people on the top exploiting you, and whether it be patriarchy, whether it be day-to-day racism in your life, the top-down nature of charity, top-down nature of employment. We want a more horizontal society, right? That's egalitarianism, shared power. That's anarchism. It's still governance. It's still, in fact, order. That anarchy symbol with a circle and an A, the O is for order. Did bet you didn't know that. Because it's a different kind of order. In fact, it's more orderly. It's more order than the chaos of dog-eat-dog. And the strongest man and the person at the top is the one in charge. That cannot be justified, no matter how benevolent or good their intentions are. So with that, I'm going to go turn to WikiHow. How to be an anarchist. How is one an anarchist? This is a question I ask myself quite a lot in college and even in the last... since Occupy Wall Street, particularly. I, for one, had the same mainstream views of anarchism. I just didn't really have a judgment. I didn't know anything about it. And if I did have any thoughts, they were kind of negative. I don't know how it's practical. But that's without knowing anything about it. And with, you know, so let's go for some basics. How to be an anarchist. Here's a little step-by-step guide. Nice little simplistic breakdown. Sometimes anarchy is the result of economic and political collapse accompanied by lawlessness. So you could find yourself with unruly mobs, strongmen, and bullies in charge. Would people try to hole up, defending their goods and supplies themselves with the help of their friends and family? Police might be volunteers, local posses, makeshift jails and courts overloaded. The setting up of informal states, as it were. Probably people in mass confusion experiencing mobs, gangs, violence, and general chaos. That is usually the image of anarchy. The Purge and other movies use the term in that way. But anarchism is not a system of chaotic failings, but rather a number of strains towards a new order. So here are some basic steps for being an anarchist, like myself. Resist conforming to the system of hierarchical authorities, meaning government, government, corporations, and by government, the state, right? The state. You can have governments. You know, there's your neighborhood association has governments, but it doesn't. It's not a state. It doesn't police anyone. It doesn't make rules everyone has to follow. Unless they make some kind of contract, in which they do, which like those cul-de-sacs. So there's two methods to being an anarchist, and this is also kind of a good overview of just general principles and such. So method one is educating yourself. So the first question, and I'm just talking about anarchism, but this goes for any ideology. Something that is left out of our curriculum in schools is comparative ideology. I feel lucky enough, privileged enough, that the Albany School District included in the world history course comparative religion, that we compared the main religions to each other. Not in some judgment way, but just to actually know what each of their fundamental qualities are. So talking about Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, and maybe like a general other category for shamanism and other such religions. Defining what a religion is at its very core, a system of beliefs and rituals, which can refer to many things, by the way, which is why I don't follow that line of religion poisons everything. Top-down hierarchical religion is poisonous, but that to me it's the hierarchy that poisons things, not the religion. So I was in the atheist movement that had that kind of view, and I wasn't always there with that because I figured it was dogma and hierarchy that was the problem, the top-down nature, and that's what led me to being more an anarchist than an atheist activist. Promoting atheism and godlessness and all that. So decide whether or not you support anarchism, the planned chaos and policies of reverting to a less structured, more horizontal life without government or state controls, with block or union committees, which can be seen as a bit of tribalism, but then these tribes can then join in confederations, federations, and scale up. This means studying, researching, and learning about anarchism. Reading some basic introductions is the first step. Familiarize yourself with the ideas of some of the most important anarchist theorists and writers. So here is a short list, and then we'll hit our last break. So there are 19th century anarchist writers, the same time as Marx and other and all the beginning socialist movements. Writers like Joseph Proudhon. He coined the term properties theft. Peter Kropotkin, Daniel De Leon, Mikhail Bakunin, another Russian, who wrote God and the State. Kropotkin read, he wrote what's called the Bread Book, which is called Conquest of Bread. It's called Conquest of Bread. And in that, he kind of outlines his own kind of model of how anarchist revolution would go, and it wouldn't have to include violence. Alexander Berkman, who wrote the ABCs of Communist Anarchism. I think this is late 19th century. And Benjamin Tucker. Then you can also read 20th century modern writers like Emma Goldman, Anarchism and Other Essays. Enrico Masatina, who just wrote a book called Anarchy. Alfredo Bononona, who is a main theorist. Bob Black, who wrote The Abolition of Work. Wolfie Lenstricker, his work Willful Disobedience, John Zerzan. There's Murray Bookchin. There's a popular meme, Google Murray Bookchin. Why? He's a bit more recent. He died recently. And his prodigy is also publishing books about horizontal bottom-up democracy and how it can work into movements. There's the Crime Thing X Workers Collective. They wrote a book called Recipes for Disaster, and they also put together the main booklet that I leave out around Albany. And then there's, for Brit, Colin World, Anarchism, A Very Short Introduction. And, of course, there's Chomsky. He's the most mainstream anarchist. But you'll notice lately, when it comes to promoting what policies he promotes, it's all social democracy. Go figure. The second part of Method 1 of education. Read up on the different schools of thought. There are many different types of anarchism. So there are dozens of them, in fact. There's more libertarian types. There's anarcho-communism, which is... So, if you didn't know, the main thing about general communist theory, or what is communism, it's that you establish socialism by having a period with complete state control, right? And that's usually the part that we all agree, there's a good consensus that totalitarian government is bad. So, merely to be an ANCOM, an anarcho-communist, is to disagree with that and say, no, we can achieve socialism without a period of authoritarian government. The main argument from the Marxist-Leninist or the communists who do believe that we need that period of government control will point out that the only socialist governments that ever seem to make headway and survive are the ones that have those authoritarian qualities. A little bit of Cuba, Soviet Union, China, but they're always kind of corrupted, or the problems of being top-down authoritarian are there. So those criticisms to make, but that's a debate to have a different time. There's a syndicalist anarchism, which is based particularly just on that labor unions are the government. And that's kind of what Chomsky is. It's his heart. Platformism, in which you do anarchist and communist practice, create socialism, but in a non-centralized way. You join other organizations and just influence them, but do so in an honest fashion. Bring up your ideas and say, hey, let's try this. Post-left anarchism, I'm not going to get into that. And there's mutualism, which just particularly outlaws income from interest, and meaning interest on banks, on savings, rents, and stocks and bonds, and etc. So it just bans income from just the actual incomes that come from not working, that just come from investment. People should not just make their living just by investing. Everyone is making economic decisions in their day-to-day life and how to invest their time and money and so on. Why should someone get rent from doing that? Working landlords are putting in labor. You can familiarize yourself with the history of anarchism. Read about anarchist movements like the Spanish Revolution of 36. There's the Menshevist uprising in Ukraine, and they established a little small area. There was also one in Korea, but it's not well documented because it was crushed very quickly. There was the Paris Commune of 68. And there's today's Black Blocs, which are informal organizations. And movements, movement events, or rather events that were, a governance was used to organize large protests, like in the World Trade Conference in Seattle, that's 99. And Occupy Wall Street, which is how I got introduced to anarchism. I was ignorant, and then I did General Assemblies, and then I'm talking about the Zuccotti Occupy Wall Street. With that direct governance, the General Assembly, the way things were, you had working groups, committees, and there was a horizontal structure. And I was in love with it. I'm like, this feels real. This feels where other institutions, I feel empty part of the time I'm there. Like, I'm not able to fully interact with this. There's all these walls of bureaucracy, Robert's rules in the way. That's fixed here. Like, not perfect, but way better. And then I'm told that I was doing anarchism. I'm like, really? That's what this is? And then I read more, and the rest is, well, here I am. But another important step that I've already mentioned is to understand and assess the negative connotations of anarchy. Take what you've learned about anarchism and reflect on those negative connotations. There are many negative stereotypes about anarchism, many associated with violence, arson, vandalism. Certain direct actions do propagate that, but if they're, that's kind of the smallest bit of it, you know. Doing really free markets and item swaps and community meals, that is not more of it. It is the basis of anarchist practice and the challenging of power, the private property ownership by smashing a window. That is the least of it. The least of it. I mean, there's a reason. It happens once a year. It's hardly a lot of it. But like any system of thought, you'll have to try to assess how people would create and enforce anarchism. I don't like the word enforce, but propagate, continue, establish it. You know, have community accountability. And I know that it's possible. You set up groups. There's a community accountability board here in Albany, and that is community accountability. It is enforced by state and courts, but really it's a program within it, and to me, it could easily exist outside of it. It's just a matter of sending offenders right to the board instead of to the court, which then says, you'll go to the board. Because that's how it currently is. Familiarize yourself with anarchist symbols and flags. Like all political movements, we use symbols to identify ourselves. These symbols are based on place and have changed over time. But generally, there's the red and the black, those two colors together. There's that anarchy symbol that you might be familiar with, usually used as a joke, or sometimes it flashes up in pop music. There's a point to be made about punk and how punk is dead, because as soon as it was commodified, as in co-opted, like as soon as there were shirts in Hot Topic with punk logos and messages, that a price tag, I mean, that punk culture is something that's now sold and marketed to say, look, express your disaffection with the system by buying punk stuff and wearing anarchy logos and have anarchy logos on your stuff, but not understand anything about it or to actually be making any difference. You're still part of the system by doing that, by consuming and almost ironically being punk, or just using the fashions of it. And as soon as that's the case, well, punk is no longer really punk. If you're going to be countercultural, you have to be authentic. That means less irony. That means being sincere in wanting change and doing something about it. Working with others, finding people of like mind. Those are the things that this article lists. So do more comparative ideology, meaning understanding capitalism. And I think understanding capitalism, like, I have coworkers, other people, and maybe people in your life, who have explained, they have shouted out that they do not understand this bullcrap. Recent point. Cosby was finally convicted for all the raping he's been doing over the years. And there's kind of been a narrative by those with, it's like, we want to be nuanced, that this is a bit of an injustice. It's like OJ all over again. And what they're saying is that it's not injustice that he was convicted, but it's that he's the only one who seems to be convicted. Why hasn't Weinstein been sent to jail? Has he been arraigned on charges yet? I don't even know. It hasn't been mainstream news like the Cosby conviction has been. And of course, there's what comes to mind usually is Trump. Trump hasn't been convicted on any of his abuse of people. It was evidence that's more recent than that was used in Cosby's conviction. And so they're generally saying the injustice is systemic, that the whole system is illegitimate. Not because Cosby was convicted, which I would say is a good thing. It's a step forward. But I think there's a skepticism that it is because, A, it's an old black man. And then there's all these white abusers who may have had some social consequences, but otherwise they're not going to jail. Let alone, they're just talking about sexual crimes, not the war crimes of our presidents. All presidents have committed war crimes. All state leaders pretty much have, one way or another. Let's see. And of course, take your time. When you're building and developing your worldview, don't rush it. Question whether or not you're doing, you're looking into it because it's a fad or because you're bored. I made a concerted effort in college to figure out what I believed and why, to build up my personal ideology. How am I going to look at the world? To make decisions like what news do I want to consume? Or what news am I going to trust? And what basis am I going to use to trust it? Or what analysis am I going to do when I read something? What am I going to choose to be skeptical about? To be skeptical of everything is to really burn yourself out. And so these are the things bouncing around my mind, and hopefully yours as well. To answer that fundamental question, what do you believe and why? Not just about God, faith, but how the government should be. How do you interact with people? What do you believe about your daily interactions? Have you thought about it? Not so. It's a bit of work, and I took the time, i.e., college, to do that work on myself. So maybe it's just something you can do a little bit in your spare time. I know that's possible too. So with that, we'll break down the show. So if you like this show, go to our Facebook page. We have a Patreon now as well. Support the show with some ducats. Like the Facebook page. I post show notes there. Not lately. I'm kind of holding off until we're actually fully online, because we're not. People ask me, everybody listen to the show. I don't have a good answer yet. Working on that. Slowly. Making, kind of playing the waiting game at the moment. Just as you are, as I bring up the music.
Today when as you love, sera le genre humain. Manchang的热血已经沸腾，要为真理而斗争。就是这大哥哥挽留谁努力们起来，不要说我们一无所有，我们要做天上的主人。就是最后的斗争，团结起来到明天，你看那就来。
Yeah.